This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
My name is George Jing Lin. I am the founder of a youth market trends research company called Untapped, and I'm also the partner in a brand strategy and design firm called A Dozen Cookies.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Thanks, George. Thanks for coming on today. What's it mean to be Vietnamese to you now?
I don't know, man. I really don't know. I wrestle with that every single day. I think part of the reason when you and I first talked that you were interested in having this conversation with me is because I took a sort of a sideways route midway through my career and found an opportunity in Vietnam. And I went to go work in Vietnam for 5 years running one of the multinational ad agencies over there. And I did it because I'd always had this sort of yearning to really feel like I was Vietnamese, because I was born in 77. My parents got here in 75, and sort of that very first group of the next generation to be born here without that sort of memory. You know, a lot of my friends who came over even at like 4 or 5 years old had some initial memories of coming over and sort of the trauma that was attached to it. I was born in this country without that trauma. You know, the traumas I dealt with were my parents' traumas and the community's traumas. But I bring that up to say, like, I always felt disconnected from Vietnam. You know, I was Vietnamese hyphen American. You know, and so I will tell you the one thing that I felt living in Vietnam was I'm also not Vietnamese, weirdly enough, you know, and not in the sense of like heritage wise, culturally, but like you land there and they make it very, very clear, you know, Viet Kieu, you know, had some kid one time, funny enough, and kind of just like patting my belly going, they don't make them like you around here, you know. And so it's hard for me to answer that question. You know, I think like there's some folks who come on and sort of confidently answer it. And I think why I value what you're doing is because there's a whole segment of us that live in between, you know, we're trying to figure it out for ourselves right now. And being Vietnamese American or Vietnamese Australian, you know, any of us that are this next generation, whether Viet Kieu or Gặp Việt, is a unique segment all on its own. So I can tell you what the Vietnamese American experience is like right now, but to answer like, what does it mean to be Vietnamese? I'm struggling to wrap my head around it.
Yeah. I share that with you. I share it with you. And I don't think that you're like what you said in the very beginning, like it'll ever be answered. But that's a beautiful thing at this point. I've embraced that.
It's a really unique opportunity, right? Yes. Like you don't have to look at it as like a negative thing. It's an exciting and interesting opportunity. in the last 5 years, coming back to the, I've been back in the States probably for like 7 years now, in the last 5 years, even the last like three and a half, has been really heartwarming in New York, where I've watched Vietnamese culture, Vietnamese food step into the spotlight, you know? And I remember I used to joke that people would say to me when I first lived in New York, like, you know, where can you go to go get good Vietnamese food? And I was like, California, you know, you couldn't find it here to save your life, you know, yep. Or like, come on over, you know? And now, you know, restaurants popping up in the New York Times, you look at like Saigon Social, like getting a lot of love, and when Coffee Supply getting a lot of love. And it warms the heart, because now all of a sudden it's like stepping into the spotlight. Are we having that moment, at least in those critical elements of popular culture, that are highlighting, you know, where we're from, our heritage, and our values? Like, you know, Kellen Ray Chan wearing an Ao Yai. Like, my kids got a doll of her, like, rocking that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, and after she saw it, then she was like, this is so pretty. And then, like, she went into her closet. I'm like, you have, like, two or three of those. Like,
wow.
You know, and she was six. And, like, she went into her closet and, like, put them on and came out. And she's like, okay, you know, this is really cool. Whereas before, she was like, okay, this is great, but what is it?
Yeah. So. Shout out to Saigon Social, Helen and Sarah over at Win Coffee Supply. I was there last month and I got to meet both of I've known Sarah for a while, but just got to meet Helen. She's coming on soon to the podcast as well.
Oh, very cool. Look, so many of the Vietnamese friends I know beeline for that place. Like,
yeah, it's so weird that you mentioned those two ladies, you know? It's like Saigon Social and Win Coffee Supply.
It's the highest profile because it hits on just a very critical cultural element in New York, which is obviously the food scene, right? So,
but there's like a dozen other places. Why Saigon Social? I just want to hear your viewpoint. I mean, I know the answer for me, but I just
because they're doing it in the younger generation's way. They're doing it through social media, and that's how it's spreading through word of mouth, right? Like, let's face it, the restaurants that have been around few years back, they're not doing it the same way, because maybe they're my age, you know, and I'm full on, like, you know, dad bod trying to figure out, like, hey kids, how does the TikTok work? Someone show me how to plug in the VCR, you know. But they're hitting on those notes, and so the word is spreading very quickly, rapidly. They're maintaining a high profile, and I'm here for it, you know. I'm glad someone's doing it.
Absolutely. So,
yeah,
absolutely. You know, I've had different branding professionals on. You're probably the fourth or fifth, and it's good to hear you guys' perspective, because I'm interested in Vietnamese as a brand, and as someone who's lived in Vietnam yourself. If I were to come to you and I had like a bags of cash as a billionaire, and the task that I gave you was to redesign the image, the brand of the Vietnamese people worldwide, what kinds of things do I need to start asking?
What's the hook? Right. I was having a similar conversation with a friend the other day, and they were asking about the Asian hierarchy, you know, and sort of that jokingly, like, where it all stacks up and stands through everything. But one of the things that came out of it that I thought was a very practical side of the discussion was the ownable nature of accomplishments. Right. And so I know you and I've talked about like Korean culture in the past and like the rapid ascent that they've made in the entertainment industry. But today, when you talk about Asian pop music, people right away go to K-pop. Right. So there's an ownable equity there. Right. You want to talk about fashion. Most people will right away go to Japan, right? Shibuya. There's an ownable equity there. Someone's going to crucify me for this, I'm sure, and one of my Filipino friends. But when you look at all the amazing things that Filipino culture is known for, very few of them are ownable equities to the country, right? Athletic, great dancers, wonderful beaches, good singers, all absolutely true, right? There's a number of wonderful things that you can sort of like associate with the culture and the people from a values and equity standpoint. And I'm talking about this from like a marketing standpoint, yep. right? In the way that I might go, like, Porsche's fast, you know, and Fords are tough. But none of those equities are singularly ownable to Filipino culture right now, right? In that regard. And I think that's what makes it tough. And I think the first question I would ask, if you say, okay, rebrand Vietnamese culture for me or the Vietnamese people, the first question I'd ask you is like, okay, where are we going to put our hook? You know, is it going to be in the food? And I think that's like one of those really unique of the moment ownable things right now, is that Vietnamese food has like a very unique flavor profile, a complexity, you know, that stands out. You know, I'm taking a look at like VinFast filing for IPO. Is it going to be like an entrepreneurial nature? You know, because it may not be like in the technical expertise, but it may be in the ambition and the energy, right? And I think maybe like 20 years back, it was still tied to the war. And then like 15 years back, it was tied to factories and labor. And those are not owned marketing hooks that I run with, you know?
But how do you make something like K-pop? How do you make something that is ownable? How do you corner it? Because why didn't the Filipinos corner music? How did they not get into the mindset? Because their singers and their musician artists are, you know, probably way ahead in the American game than any other Asian, I would argue, right? But how is it that they did not own it? They didn't own their P-pop, like Filipino pop, whatever. How did the Koreans come to have that ownable hook, that ownable corner?
I think it's more because I admit my familiarity with Filipino culture is very limited, right? So again, I say like, I'm probably gonna get crucified for this by some of my Filipino friends. But because the music, the culture, the art is also taps into like the very sort of mainstream culture element of it. Korean pop would have been live. And quite literally like English language songs, right? Come out the gate, like new lead singer Journey, you know, last name is Banana, but he's singing those songs perfectly to a T in the English language. That's not ownable. You know, he has an ownable equity, but that's not something that's like uniquely tied to the culture.
Yeah. Right. Or Apple D, the Black Eyed Peas.
Exactly. There's a right. lot for the Philippines. Exactly what you're saying.
But there's nothing.
But it's in the general sphere, right? You know.
Okay, but this is why this is important. This dialogue, this is actually the first time I've heard of this concept of ownable corner, right? The ownable equity. And it makes perfect sense, like as I'm thinking about what you're saying. But now I want to get down to the mechanics. How do you get a country to find an ownable piece of equity out there?
I don't think you own food, but you can own a niche within it, right? Within that, like make a name for it. Like for a majority of Americans, I have no data to prove this, but I'm guessing like if your family vacation is a Winnebago to Vegas, the only thing you know about Japanese cuisine is sushi, right? But there's like a unique singular item that is an ownable equity. Lululemon, it's a black pant until like all of a sudden it becomes more than that. But whenever I talk to a company or a brand and I go, okay, what's your black pant? What's the very first thing that you're going to have? The singular thing that you're going to get known for, and then you can sort of like land and expand, right? You've got that one thing that everyone thinks you are fucking great at this. You're the best at it in the world. I want this. You're the only one I'm going to go to for this. Like, you know, you probably own sandwiches. you know, I think we have bigger aspirations than that. Definitely like coffee is something that we can own. And I think that's why what Sarah's doing is amazing. And plus her sticker game is tight, but you know, those are like those unique individual things that you just sort of, you start with, and then you kind of, you start spinning a bunch of plates, and then you look and you go, that's the one that's going, that's the one people are responding to and resonating to. All right. You start to pour energy into that. Right. And you think back to like K-pop at one point, you go like, okay, there was Rain. Then there was the Wonder Girls. And then it all came, right? You know, but it didn't like start as a flood. It started as like a trickle. And then you're like,
yeah.
Ooh.
A lot of it was serendipitous too. You know, Jurassic Park came out in the theaters in Korea. I think it was in 94 or something like that. All of a sudden, the theatrical people in the theater side were like, wait a minute. We need to sell 1.4 million Hyundais to make one sale like this Jurassic Park in the theaters. Everybody's just like, all right, fuck this. We're going to go all in the theater business, movie production business. It's like, but that's serendipity, right? Like, it took somebody to recognize that for that to happen.
And the willingness and sort of the mobility to like run after it when you see it, right? I think average person is good for like 5 or 6 opportunities in their life. But how many of them are like well suited to like take advantage of that moment and go after it?
So true, you know, man.
Sarah's a really good example. I don't know her personally, but like how many Vietnamese people know how to make a cafe sedan and have a cafe fiend in the house? Like a ton of us. How many of us have like gone back and forth? A ton of us. How many of us saw an opportunity and said, I'm going to do something with this and, you know, have the wherewithal to promote it, sink my life into it and like make it into something. One, her, right?
There's her and then there's Song Kai-jin, right? There's Daniel Huai-tin. Those two are operating. And you know, the crazy thing is like they did 10 years in something way different than these beverages. You know, Daniel Huai-tin was, you know, working, you know, in the community, you know, for the regrowth after Katrina in the Gulf. And Sarah was working in media for like a good many years before she got to coffee. So, you know, it takes these sort of powerhouses. They're very intellectual and very sharp people that get into these lateral moves over into the beverage space, and they just get the ecosystem so well, and they get it. Yeah. They get the taste down, they get the marketing down, and they're able to drive it.
Well, and then you don't always have to get it all. Nothing's ever perfect at first, right?
Yeah.
When you look at like other entrepreneurial stories, you look at Vuori, right? As a brand, and the founder talks about how like almost lost his lunch on like the first initial investment he had and then sort of like figured it out. So yeah, I mean, any one of those, but I think the bigger point is just that it's not just like spotting the opportunity, but spotting the opportunity, having the desire, having the ambition, and having the ability to execute all together in those moments to take advantage of the opportunity, you know, and now you're starting to see some of those spaces. And maybe those are going to be the thing that start to create for different perceptions and those ownable equities for Vietnam, Vietnamese people, Vietnamese culture, you know? And I think that's the start, but I don't think sitting down and going, okay, here's the plan. I think it's more about sitting down and spotting where are we starting to see movements, you know, and then how do we get in front of them and take advantage of it and sort of like ride that wave? Because India has got a phenomenal film industry, right? They don't necessarily own movies. They carved out a niche of a specific type or genre of film that has a recognizable sort of like a familiar thread that runs through all of them. You know, the music, the dance, the dress, and all of a sudden, now you have this like branded equity. Now the challenge is how do you get beyond that? Because anyone who spent a minute in India knows that there's so much more to the place than Bollywood and curries, you know? So now they're looking at those other parts. I was lucky enough, like a few years back, to work on a branding project with a big multinational out of India. And they were trying to figure out like, how do we talk about all these other things? Like the number one selling tractor in America is actually from an Indian company.
Wow.
No one goes, ooh, Indian farmers, you know? So those are all the things that I think as a people we need to think about. But we have bigger challenges when it comes to our branding, you know? And it really starts with, I think, our fragmentation. There's still a lot of Vietnamese people in America who are not proud of Vietnam, who don't want to go and like rep it, you know? Those challenges have to be solved before it becomes easier to brand the country. When in fact, like, arguably we're a split brand.
Do we solve it, or we just let people die off?
Man,
I mean, I've talked about this. It's deep.
I know. I've heard you, but I don't know the answer to it, right? I think there needs to be a turning point that becomes a point of pride that everyone can get behind, that sort of like supersedes all of that, or we do wait, you know? And truth be told, it's what, a 30-year window? So I mean,
what's a 30-year
window? As much as I sort of like hate to think about it,
it's real 30 talk. More years? You're saying it's 30 more years?
No, I'm saying 30 more years until like everyone who is Vietnamese is born post-war, right? That there's no more survivors of the war and sort of that fragmented population. Right now, let's face it, like for a lot of people in Australia or America or France, when they think about Vietnamese people, they don't think about people in Vietnam. They think about the Vietnamese people that they've grown up around in their community, who have come over as refugees, who have a very specific point of view and represent the brand in its own way, in a different way than perhaps it is in Vietnam right now.
You know, I don't know if we're going to have to wait for a very long time. I have a feeling, just a hunch, that this new HBO series, The Sympathizer, is going to change some hearts and minds everywhere.
I think some, right? Yeah. But you're talking, I guess for me, you're talking about something much bigger, which is you're talking about like a national branding, right?
Yeah, but here's
like
why. Here's why I mean that. Because it's not just this idea of HBO, Robert Downey Jr., Gao Ki Ying, all these big names. And there's people from Vietnam that are in the thing. And then there's people who are like, who never set foot in Vietnam, young Vietnamese kids that are playing the main parts coming out of like all over America and Canada and Australia. But the thing is this, the actual content of this story, the premise, the theme, the actual word sympathizer, it can go a lot of crazy ways, man. And if you've read the book, the deeper implications of what this is all about is like, open your mind and your eyes up to see every angle here. And I think that once mainstream America, it shows in all these mainstream English speaking countries, it'll change the hearts and minds of young people and old people alike, to kind of neutralize the way we're looking at things and change the way we. So I think it's going to be a dialogue enhancer. If anything, it's going to start us thinking about things differently instead of just taking a one-sided approach to everything. It's not binary. And I think that that's what the sympathizers here, it's going to do. It's going to have us think about things in a non-binary, much more wide way of looking at our history. Shit's not black and white.
It's not, but I'm trying to compartmentalize the conversation here, right? Like, part of this discussion is around the notion of like, how do you brand it, right? And I look at the sympathizer and I go, first off, like, so excited about it happening, but it's a period piece at the same time, right? It's coming out on HBO Max. And I think you, from a branding standpoint, you would see a bigger impact and effect if after the film, the people involved from production to directors, writers, actors, then start to move into a bunch of different pieces where you start to see them as like a next generation, a next wave of theatrical talent.
Yep.
That for me is like something that culturally will have a bigger impact. I think what you're talking about here is a conversation that a lot of us are having with our parents where we're going like, hey, you want to come back to Vietnam? And they're like, no, I'm not ready to go back. Some parents are and some parents aren't yet, because for them, and I can't even imagine the pain that they're probably feeling when you discuss sort of being ripped away from your home, you totally. Know, like a whole generational trauma and PTSD. So like there's all my empathy and sympathy for that.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about like mass culture, it's sometimes it's a lot more superficial. You know, it's got to be something like people can get excited and get behind. Arguably, Vietnam and the Women's World Cup, I know you talked about this on a previous podcast, might be more of that challenging moment, which is like you want to cheer for your people, but you don't want to put on a kit. Look, I've got a national team jersey somewhere in the house, and I love it. But I'm not wearing that in LA.
You wear it in New York?
I'll wear it in New York. I'll wear it at home. You know, I'll rock it walking around here. But also because like majority of New Yorkers are ignorant enough that they wouldn't even know what it is.
Yeah.
You know? I might argue that I know. A number of Vietnamese Americans wouldn't know like where the shirt's from because like the team hasn't been promoted well enough, right? Probably think that I'm like, you know, Chinese ping pong player or some shit. But that's sort of a harsh reality of it right now, right? Yeah.
Korea didn't have to go through that.
They didn't have to go through that,
yep.
Right? And look, I've got 3 red stripes tattooed on one of my arms, right? And I was talking with a friend and she's just laughing. She's like, better cover that shit up when you come home.
How old were you when you got that?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe like it was after I lived in Vietnam, like 5-6 years ago.
Oh, shit. Wait a minute. Uh-huh. Hold up. Why did you do it after you left Vietnam? That's significant, man.
Oh, there just weren't a lot of tattoo parlors in Saigon at the time. Now there's a proliferation.
No. It's significant that you got the 3 stripes. Like, why the 3 stripes? What, like, that's a statement to me.
It is. It's a statement about, like, who I am and you know, what I'm about. Like, my kids' names tattooed on me. Like, I don't have tattoos that are just purely for decoration. Every one of them sort of represents one of the elements and building blocks of who I am. And I think this goes back to what we were talking about. Is like, one of the things that I love living in Vietnam. I would love to retire there. It is my favorite place on earth. But I embraced and accepted living there as an American with Vietnamese roots that was close to the culture, but never truly within it. But I didn't, when living there, I wasn't made to feel excluded the way that I sometimes feel in the United States, right?
Great point.
Like it was always like jokingly, but they never let me forget it, you know. But it's like, yeah, you're still an American, you know. And even here, people are like, you're a New Yorker, you know. So there are those elements within it and those labels. But I think coming home, one, when I was there, I probably would have gotten more ink, but like at the time, there just wasn't a lot of places that were reputable that I was comfortable going to go get a tattoo. I would get tattoos when I came home, but like each trip I would probably like, I picked up like a tattoo for my wife, you know, and next trip back, I picked up something else and then so on and so forth. You know? But at a certain point, it is because my identity is firmly grounded in a very specific part of Vietnamese history and a specific subculture within Vietnamese people.
I'm like processing it. I'm like,
I'm waiting for like this phone call from my dad going, did you really fucking call us a subculture? So
No, no, no. Those 98 million people in Vietnam, that's a subculture. That's what he's saying.
He is, right? I mean, I don't blame him. It's got to be hard. It's got to be so, so hard. You know?
It is. You know, but, you know, I have been doing a lot of thinking about this, right? Okay, so, let's take it back to our grandparents' generation, right? My dad's dad got killed in 1945, died in 1945. Mm-hmm. He was the town or the province's chief of police, right? He got assassinated by Viet Minh, which is the modern day evolution of communists, right? But they're not really communists yet at that time, 1945, I guess, right? So who was my grandfather serving at the time? Who was he working for that the nationalists, the people of Vietnam, had to assassinate him? He was a French, right? He's working for the French, right? Right? He's working for the French.
His logical conclusion.
Huh? Right?
It's a logical conclusion.
Right, yeah. He's a French pawn. But I was very proud of my grandfather growing up my entire life. But then I just started to think about these things. These are things I'm really thinking about all the time now. Then his three sons, my dad's siblings and him, three of these guys make it into the elite, police force. They serve under the CIA. Some of them get sent to Quantico, Virginia twice in the 60s. And they serve who? Who are they serving? They're serving white guys again. Yeah. Their dad served a white guy. Their son served a white guy. Then the third guy, the third generation gets born. Me, I get born. What does my dad name me? He names me after a white guy. He names me after the sponsor that
my name's George.
on paper, is that what they named you when you were born?
My dad actually wanted to name me G because that's my grandmother's name. Uh-huh. And he actually didn't think that she was going to make it to the States.
So you put George.
That was weird. George Jing Wen.
On your birth certificate. Mine is Kenneth Eugene Wynn. So here's my point. We got three generations of white guy, white guy, white guy. Like all influenced somehow. And it just, when I think about this, I'm like, wait a minute. This is trippy. Because when I think about this now and I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't know if this is a history that I feel very proud of sometimes when I think about, when I think about that, it's like, And I love my uncles. I love my father. They're all gone now. Grandfather, was gone before my father was 6 months old, so everybody's passed away. And you're right. I have a lot of empathy for the loss. I have empathy for the lives that, the destruction and the trauma. But at the end of the day, I wonder how much of a choice each man had when they were thinking about service.
Yeah.
And I'll stand up to any grown-up and talk about this shit. Because I talked to my father, talked to my uncle, I talked to all of these guys when they were alive.
I mean, I think that's fair, right? But it's not just, this is a different situation, right? This isn't just fathers, brothers and sons. This is mothers and daughters, grandmothers. This is being told you have to leave. In every one of those elements you talked about before, then you want to even go further back, Japanese colonization. Every round of it, never had to leave. Never had to leave and be left alive and look back and go, shit.
I know, but it's think about there. Why did we have
99.
To leave? But why did we have to leave? Right? That's the thing.
No, but can I mean, you're talking about an era of folks who are genuinely afraid for their lives.
Sure,
A friend of mine was telling me the story of his mother coming to the beach, holding two young boys and looking at the guys who are running the boats and going, if you don't let us on, I'm going to scream and they're going to show up and they're going to kill us all, because that's how afraid they were to leave.
And shit did go down that way too.
Yeah. Right. These are the stories that blew my mind. Cause I was born here. I was okay, I woke up and for a certain age, I was like, I'm American, looking around. And it's like, wait, why am I dead? Oh, okay. Wait, okay. This is really different. Right. And, you know, kids don't process everything and parents don't want to share the context and share the horrors with them. And so it's a different scenario, I think, than everything else that you previously described, because like whatever the rationale or the reasons for what they participated in, they're in country, hoping to affect some sort of change, benign, malevolent, whatever it may be, right? But like stay in country trying to affect change. It's like, yo, you got to go. You can't come back. You didn't just lose, but like get off the court. We go back for the first time in 99 and I go back on a family trip, right? I graduate from university and they go, okay, here's your graduation present. We're going to take you to Vietnam. You've been asking for years and it's open now and we finally feel safe. Let's go. We go by one house. And this is, I think, to your point, did you have to leave? We go by one house and we realize this is where my mom used to live. It's now gotten turned into an apartment building, right? So first off, trying to process the fact that my mom's family home is now an apartment building. What kind of life did y'all live? So from a very practical standpoint, yes, they had to go because someone came and wanted their shit. Like, that's just like, you're going to get robbed. You need to go. Came by another house. My mom just kind of like couldn't help herself. She's like, my best friend growing up lived here. Rang the doorbell. And they were there. She came out. So to your point, like, did they have to leave? Answered like a very straightforward no. Like there are people who didn't, but I also don't have real insight into what kind of life they had during that time. You know, my grandfather, my paternal grandfather chose not to leave. He chose to stay. He said, look, I'm old enough. This is my house. I live in Minzung. This is all I got. I'm going to stick around with like one of my cousins. Last cousin came over in like 2001, 2002 and stayed to take care of grandpa. And like this one old guy is like, my house, you know, like, you know, I'm just imagining him taking his slipper off and like waving at people going, get off my yard, you know? So, I mean, that question is like, I don't know, but I do believe that everyone who left genuinely felt like they had no choice. Whether we want to look back and have a rational discussion and say, did you really have a choice? Did you not? You know, I don't know. That starts to move into some Kanye shit.
Some murky waters.
Yeah, some very, and I can't comment on that, but I can comment on genuinely believing that they had to go. When you look at like the trauma they put themselves through.
They had to go. No doubt about it. No doubt about that. Yeah.
So, but I mean, like, this is where this conversation goes. So that's why I say, like, I don't know if you're going to get to a place where, like, you change the way we as a people in totality are perceived, as long as we can't come to terms with that as a people. You know, in that you have such significant populations that have those opposing viewpoints and perceptions who influence the people around them, right? So that so many Americans today will say, I've had some experience with Vietnamese folks, and the more progressive or liberal ones or live on the coasts who interact with Vietnamese cultures are going to have like, you know, very positive views on it, but they're going to see us one way versus another. Whereas like, I don't think that's the case with some of these other cultures that you're referencing, where people have emerged. There is no like unique identity for like, well, I as an outsider don't perceive like a unique identity on like a Korean American or a Japanese American, other than like, hey, you just sort of lost a little bit of the flavor, not you have a different flavor. Right.
That's a great point.
And Japan's in the World Cup. Every one of them's out there, like,
yeah,
rocking the samurai kid. Right. Korea goes down 4-1. Everyone's crying, you know. So
Japan, everybody's cleaning stadiums. It's one way of looking at everything. Yeah.
You know, I still, you know, you'll still have like aunts and uncles who insist that like they said it wrong because they say it with a Hanoian accent. Mm-hmm. You know, like can't agree on some of those things. So that I think is the bigger branding challenge. But I think when you have the superficial elements like business and culture and entertainment that start to emerge and we find something that's uniquely ownable, I think that's when you start to like carve out that space. I love what Tai Nguyen is doing with Aoi Eyes. He's so passionately dedicated to bringing that back, right? And putting it in the spotlight and an appreciation for that artifact and turning it into like high fashion. And it's like, okay, you know, when you start to see that like rocking runways, you know, and you see like a DVF or like, you know, Balenciaga like steal that as inspiration for like the next thing they do instead of stealing shit from IKEA, that's when you go, okay, like we're firmly ensconced within pop culture. But I do think the easy ones right off the bat is going to be coffee, you know, is going to be those like easy, simple, superficial things that we can all agree on. Our coffee is great. So, you know, but that's the brand part. And it is, as a marketing guy, I'm willing to admit that, you know, branding and advertising and marketing, it tends to play at like that superficial level. You're not dealing with like the weight of the content and the cultural context and the depth of the philosophical questions. So like, it's gotta be light, snappy, memorable.
So what I'm gathering today is it's not really going to be a step-by-step paint by numbers process here. It's going to be a little different. It's going to be like, let's identify what's moving and then let's shape up behind it. Let's shape up and let's mobilize behind that.
You know, tech culture is definitely moving. Startup culture is moving. But when you think about like, what are the things that we've like really gotten into the public eye for across in the cultural conversation in the last few years? I mean, it's across the board. It's like Flappy Bird, the counting song, you know, these are like sort of these weird outliers that are fun, but are not true representations of our culture, nor do they push it forward.
And they're not ownable. They're not.
Well, I mean, it's not something I want us to own either, you know. I mean, it's awesome. I'm psyched for it. Like, you know, was singing that damn counting song to my kid when she was before she could talk. Like, but yeah, you know, is that gonna be the thing that like when people see you and go like, oh hey, you know, this is what we know you guys for. Whereas like versus like massive electronics industry and great entertainment industry, you know, and arguably you could say that about India as well, right? And they've each got their own flavor of it, a unique flavor of it. So like, what is going to be like the Vietnamese flavor of that? And you know, food, fashion might
but
be
even,
like sort
but
of.
But even India didn't do what Korea did.
No, they didn't. They did not. And that. But that is around the mobility and the desire and the energy to make the investment and do it. And
that's
I mean, has anyone been able to accomplish what Korea did in that scant period of time?
And I mean, if you think about Indonesia, you know, fourth biggest country, you know, they have a lot of millions of people. It's bigger than the US. And they have the money. India has the money, China has the money, but nobody's adopting Indian music or Chinese music or Indonesian music the way everywhere you go, they're listening to Korean pop. And it's just a beautiful thing to watch.
But everywhere you go, people are eating Chinese food. I mean,
yep.
India's got its own Chinese food. We saw a Panda Express the other day. I was like, pull over.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are it needs a certain consistency and homogeneity from a branding standpoint. Now I'm just talking about branding, right? Like you just need to have like a unified, consistent point of view on something. And we don't tend to. Korea benefited from speed, resources, but also perhaps like the smaller size and nature and sort of, again, the homogenous nature of the people being able to say like, hey, this is a thing and we're going to represent it. And then I also think like one of the big differences contextually, like where media and entertainment and culture and the speed with which it's communicated today, like things move at the speed of social, you know. And to tie this back to someone we were talking about earlier, when you asked me like, why do I pinpoint like Saigon Social or Nguyen Coffee Supply? Because they're moving at the speed of social. They're speaking in the current language of the cultural conversation in a way that everyone who came before them didn't, right? J-pop was there for a long time, but when I was young and we wanted to listen to J-pop, I was getting a cassette tape.
Yeah.
You know, we were passing that around the way our parents passed around Paris by Night. Yeah. Like, you know,
that was good
everyone
music.
Come over. And like, yeah, everyone come over. I'm going to put in the VCR. But in fact, now there is some V-pop that's starting to go around where like I'm seeing it on TikToks where it's actually like folks in China dancing to like Vietnamese pop songs, right? And so, you know, I could be completely wrong and just be misjudging the speed with which it's going to move in this current era. But I think the way we communicate just plays a really big part in it in a way that's very different than 20 years ago.
I can't wait to watch this history unfold. I mean, we're both sitting at the, you know, front court side seats. We're seeing this and, you know, I'm chomping at the bit going, where is this going? Where's this game going? You know, it's constantly moving and it's so exciting. It's really exciting to not know where and how this is being, you know, where is that one thing that's going to really take off and, you know, light up.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Yeah, and I mean, the good thing about that is to get there, we're going to get to enjoy and cheer for a lot of different heroes that represent our culture.
Yeah.
Whether that be like a Bangwin or a Helen or a Tai, you know, you push against a lot of walls before you break through. And we get to cheer for all of them. Like, I lived in Seattle for a bit, so like I get a little sad when you think about the Oklahoma City Thunder, but I'm sitting here like texting friends going, they got a Vietnamese guy on the team. It's gonna be awesome, right? I was a Pac-10 kid and I didn't go to UCLA, but I almost started cheering for UCLA like a little bit ago. I'm like, look, all right, one of us, we're there. We're on the floor. You know, so you push against a lot of these walls in a lot of different ways. And it starts to validate the claim. It validates the story. It puts you on stage and then you break through. And whichever one is the one that breaks through, I will say, I think we're going to be more excited about the sympathizer than perhaps than broad culture because it's a period piece. But that has more to do with the context of the conversation rather than the quality of the work or any sort or the testament it makes to the people involved with it, the development. And it's a leap, but I just don't think that's going to be the thing that like breaks through and puts us on the map. But you know what? You have to have those things before the final thing punches through. Again, I'll go back to the example, like the Wonder Girls were amazing, you know, but people weren't I think we were like still on MySpace and Friendster at the time. It just didn't break through in the same way for that very reason. And I think they were one of the first, they were one of the first Korean groups to like tour in the States, you know? And it's always first one through the wall gets a bloody face.
Yeah, and if you think Psy and Gangnam Style, sort of that was sort of like the thing that was like, wait, that looks really weird, but somehow really catchy and fun to keep watching over and over and over. But it was like weird at the time. And then looking back, you're like, wait a minute. That's the, one of the things that really broke the dam.
Yeah. Was that the precursor that all of a sudden you're like, made it
acceptable,
comfortable, acceptable, right?
Comfortable, you know? Right. Acceptable, comfortable. It felt normal after Psy put that out there, after Gangnam Style went fucking viral. After you watched all these other ones, you're like, wait a minute. This is fun to watch. This is, I can get into this. And it wasn't as weird, because Gangnam Style was like kind of weird. If you really think about what we were thinking before Gangnam Style. And then after that, we're just like, oh shit, whatever's coming. Oh, we got pretty faces, men and women. They're just beautiful to watch. The videos are awesome and they're fun. Yeah, and that was the one that just killed it.
Yeah. You know, that broke it through. And it was like, and I think it's interesting hearing you talk about it, though. No one called it K-pop. People called it pop, right? Mm. It was pop from a Korean guy. It wasn't K-pop yet.
Oh, wow.
It was just this, like, and then all of a sudden it like broke open like this genre, you know? And at the same time, like I think about like Hollywood and our films, and you've got wonderful Vietnamese actors, both Vietnamese American and Vietnamese actors working in Hollywood, right? And I took my daughter to Disneyland recently, and we ran into, I don't even know the character that Ming Na Wen plays. And, you know, my daughter gravitates towards her because it's the first character she sees that looks like her. And I look around and I ask them, and I go, yeah, but where's the Rose Tico? And they're like, who? I'm like, come on, man. Work at Disneyland. You're a cast member, and you can't tell me you don't know, like, the characters from, didn't you read your manual? You know, but those are sort of the things. It's like, increase the profile, right? Whereas like, we all celebrate that moment. We celebrate, you know, the character, we celebrate the accomplishment of one of our own. But until it breaks through, we're like, other people are going like, yeah, you know, like, where's our Jeremy Lin? and he still hasn't normalized like Asian people playing basketball, but first one to punch through the wall.
Yeah, he's definitely one of the guys who just like hit, you know, knocked really hard, and it's, you know, it's almost there, but yeah, that one superstar that's going to break through.
Yeah, and but it's not just the superstar that breaks through. Then it's like you got to have that that group of people that then minimizes it, makes it comfortable, right?
Yeah,
you have that. Pink. Have your Psy.
Yeah, and then your Blackpink, you know? And then your fucking BTSs, and yeah. You got to have that wave that just pushes right through, and just right through the, after the thing breaks, it just comes flooding through with the all this talent.
And there were other things that normalized in the conversation that we don't necessarily think about, right? Like there was a group that was like a flash in the pan for K-pop called 2NE1. And Microsoft used one of their hit songs in one of their ads. It just became, and then you're just putting like media dollars behind it, right? And it just becomes like a normalized part of the language. I guarantee you 99% of the people who heard the song didn't recognize it as K-pop, because it was, I think it was before we were actually formalizing as K-pop. It was a Korean girl group. At that time, it was just like Psy. It's just like, it's pop from a Korean girl group, and this is really catchy, you know? And so you start to normalize things and make it every day. Like, this starts to happen when you go to like any coffee shop, and you go, yeah, I want a Vietnamese coffee. I don't want an espresso. Then that's like, it's part of the cultural conversation, right? Because 80% of the people who go to Starbucks don't know shit about it, like Italy, except for like Chef Boyardee. So, you know, those are the places. Those are like the interesting places where it weaves into the fabric, you know? I'm stuck on food because it's just the most visible one, but you start to see those signs and symbols like popping around the codes for it, right? Go to like most ice cream shops today and you will find like a Vietnamese coffee flavor somewhere in there. Like, this is like the easy thing that like mass culture can adopt, but they can't take from us, right? So they pay tribute to it. They acknowledge our culture in the process of doing that. And so when you start to see that move across in other like ownable ways and other unique ways, you know, I'd love to see like a Vietnamese sneaker company say, fuck, everyone already knows we have the manufacturing expertise. That's
such a great point, man.
Yeah. God, so
George, that
we stopped churning out your shoe and we're making
our shit now.
Yeah. And look, China's doing that with like Anta and some of the names escape me, but they're starting to try and Li-Ning, and they're starting to try and break in, and like they go and they get like Dwayne Wade as a sponsored athlete and those kinds of things. So they're starting to break through, and then it's probably like the next one that comes over. For a long time, ASICS was in like the running era, right? And everyone, and you know, Onitsuka, and people are like, oh, you know, like that's a classic sneaker, you know, that's like that Japanese style of heritage, and that those are the things that become ubiquitous that then brand a culture outside of the culture itself, right? And I know a lot of folks probably like roll their eyes at what I'm saying because it is so superficial and it doesn't give real honor to what is great about all these individual cultures and especially our own. But the question you asked was, on a global scale, how do we change the way we're perceived?
Oh, such a great answer. I mean, something as basic as shoes, and it's not basic just because it's shoes, but it's basic because it's being the best shoes are made in Vietnam as a result of industrialization Vietnam in 20 years ago, three decades ago, whatever. And why isn't somebody taking the reins and I'm Kanye it, right? Step in and do it and be that.
Hey, you know what? That earlier conversation we had about like someone with the wherewithal in the moment, like maybe one of your next guests is going to go, hey, you know what? That was a really good point. I'm a designer. I'm going to go talk to a factory and make my own fucking sneaker, you know? But instead they're making an electronic car or an electric car, which is also amazing. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, one of my friends just took a job there. She left Mercedes. And I'm just sitting, they called me and they're like, what do you know about this company? And when they're asking, black couple from Atlanta, who I've known for years, who have been diehard car people, and she's leaving Mercedes. It's like, when I tell you the pride I felt answering the call on this initial conversation, going, wait, you're taking this seriously?
Wow.
Oh, that's awesome. And they're picking up and they're relocating and they're moving to LA. And then I'm reading about like VinFast getting ready to IPO. Like, these are the moments, you know? You know who you should talk to? You should talk to Nick Tran.
Yeah.
The CMO over at
TikTok.
Yeah. Come on, man. Use your platform. Boost us in the algorithm, man.
But didn't he get fired from TikTok or?
I don't know. Last I checked, I mean, I grew a couple degrees of separation, yeah, so I can always ask.
Some of my friends were like, you want to get Nick Tran? And I'm like, yeah, I would love to. But I think he left really on awful terms at TikTok, but I'd love to get him on. I mean, I have a friend who knows him. Yeah, definitely somebody who. But let's go back to VinFast real quick. If VinFast does bad and they just tank and they do horrible, what is that like for Vietnamese Americans?
I mean, it's gonna suck on a couple of fronts, right? I think we're on a trajectory right now that is based on high achievement that starts to relegate us to potentially the notion that we have the inability to execute at the high levels, that then it becomes, you know, is it just labor versus entrepreneurialism, like true industry versus just being industrious?
But there's also like this je ne sais quoi, like to branding as well. Like, what if it's just that magic touch that certain things like Apple's and Macs or Jay-Z or just people have that magic touch that they can just make it feel right. And what if everything else is good? The car runs well, the mechanics are there, but the design or whatever, whatever the marketing, whatever the feel of the concept of the brand, the naming of the company, VinFast, it's just this one thing that could be off, and there goes our one chance at that.
Well, so it's not our one chance, right? It's not our one chance. First off, I think that's the important thing to look at, right? Is like, this is
one chance in the car industry.
No, no. It's like one chance in the car industry in the 2020s. You know, everyone else has had the benefit of hundreds, if not thousands of years of history in developing their identities, right? You know, you keep going back and picking on one particular example because of Korea, but it's unique. There's not really a number of other nations that have been able to, or sort of peoples that have been able to build their identity in with that sort of like singularity and speed, right? And at a certain point, they really didn't either. They had a hook, and then that opened it up for everyone to go like, okay, let's take a look at Korean food, Korean culture, mm-hmm. Korean fashion, right? But it was the hook that got people to pay attention. That came very fast, but the building of the culture in and of itself, very long. You ask about like, what is it going to mean for Vietnamese Americans? Not for Vietnamese people. You said, what is it going to mean for Vietnamese Americans? I think it for a specific segment of people here who already struggle with the notion that we come from a place that is known for cheap labor, still bears the brunt of, you know, poor portrayals in war movies. You know, we're starting to push back against that, that this would be a setback in that particular regard. And what makes me really sad about that too is it goes back to our larger conversation around like the difference in perceptions of Vietnam, even within the cultures, in that I think if that happens, I think you're going to have a lot of Vietnamese Americans who are going to be happy about it.
Yeah.
And it's in the older generation, and they're going to go like, see, and that sort of schadenfreude about like, mm-hmm. they were wrong. They were always wrong. It's going to still go wrong. Right. Like, I think there are still a lot of folks who it breaks their heart that the country is growing the way it is,
yeah.
because in some ways you were effectively told, like, you don't get to be a part of this. Get out. Only to see the country succeed by adopting Western ideals. Right. You know, I used to joke with friends like America lost the war when it came to bullets and guns, but they won with MTV. You know, I can't think of a more capitalistic entrepreneurial place than Saigon right now. I only wish America was as capitalistic as Vietnam. Communism is just a label right now. There's nothing communist about that country.
Mm-hmm. Or China.
Well,
the government, though.
Well, yeah. No, I mean, but like, when you look at the practices and policy, you know, yeah. You know, and it's just, then it becomes like labels, you know, it's Republicans and Democrats. What do they really stand for? You judge them by their actions, not by their labels. So.
This has been fascinating, man. You know, I came to listen to you and your work about, you know, with youth culture. And you know, I had a
little. Sorry about that.
No. This. You know, I was trying to get into the youth conversation with you in order to get to this whole Vietnamese branding thing, but we got right to it. And I'm like, I am so much more happier because of that. You know, you got right to the point. You opened it up, and you know, you brought up a lot of things that I think for me are new, because although I've been talking about these things for 2 years, I mean, this whole idea of like an ownable equity, this ownable corner, and breaking, you know, breaking through, and then having this sort of like this wave behind you that's been prepped for many years, followed through. I think that's going to be an important indicator, an important thing to look out for in the next 10 years.
Yeah. No, I hope so, man. I hope so. You know, you always talk about how like everyone's success is built on the backs of the folks who came before you, right? And what is going to be interesting exciting and has also been a challenge is effectively you have a people that had to completely reinvent themselves 47 years ago, right? Because it's not just that you came to this country, but you had to come to this country and establish the identity here and then do that in a way that still wasn't able to build off the existing identity, right? Japanese folks who come here enjoy the benefit of building off the pre-existing equities, right? Everyone has a preconceived notion, for good or for bad, when you meet a Japanese person about what that means, right? Sort of like, it's only when they sort of break the mold that you're surprised, right? We came in as mold breakers to begin with, to say we're not, our parents' generation go, we're not like them. Well, then what do you like? And then having to like establish it, build it, prove it. And I think there were a lot of folks, at least in my parents' generation, sort of hit with a certain sense of self-loathing about our cultural identity because they didn't want to be associated with something that was so painful for them.
Yeah.
You know, so let's try hard to assimilate. Let's be American. Let's name our kids Ken and George instead of like, you know, you know, let's learn to fit in here real quick, real fast. And I was actually thinking about this recently, and what makes it different than perhaps like the Ukrainian refugees that are coming here, though, is we don't blend in, or, you know, we didn't blend in then from a population standpoint. It's not like you kind of like throw on a USA jersey and like everyone's like, oh, yeah, you know, that's Tim. They've been here forever. It's like, no. Like I said, I'm always going to be hyphen American, you know, in a way that is like very, very different than some of the other identities that are being created right now, you know. I'll tell you, like when I was a kid, not even as a kid, even today, I've never felt comfortable wearing red, white, and blue. Oh, I've never felt comfortable like
sporting it.
Sporting it. I cheer. It's part of my identity. I'm not trying to pretend that I'm not, and in no way sort of a statement about it, but it's like, you know,
it just doesn't feel right.
There's always this sort of like, there's always this feeling in the back of my head, you know, that someone's, you know, you get that like country bumpkin who's gonna like in between like spitting tobacco and chewing on a hay straw is gonna be like, you know, where'd y'all find him, you know. So it's there. I can't pretend it's not, you know, and I hope my daughter never experiences it. But
it's all contextual, man. It's all contextual. Where you live, who you roll with, where you go, what ballpark you're in, what year of the ballpark, you know, if you're at a country concert in that ballpark, it's all, you know, and I'm speaking from experience. I've went to go listen to Garth Brooks and Leanne Rimes and, you know, all these country singers back in the 90s, you know, and I was the only Asian guy in the audience. And, you know, you're right. I was never able to really sport the American flag, but I was a U.S. Marine, and I did feel the patriotism of wearing, you know, a uniform, like cami uniforms that says U.S. Marines on it with the Nguyen last name. But you're right. It just, something about it does not feel entirely comfortable. But then again, it depends on where you are too. Because if I was in a stadium full of Marines and we were all mixed up, I mean, it feels appropriate then. But at a Garth Brooks concert, to wear an American flag on my t-shirt, which a lot of people do, just feels weird. Like a handful of black guys, one Asian guy, and you know, it just feels weird.
And the irony is like from all the marks where people might say, this is what makes you American, right? You've served, born here, kids here. In what way are you less than in any other way? But sort of the judgment, because, and it's not a racial thing, it's a labeling thing. that Asian first, then Vietnamese, then Vietnamese American, right? But like, even you walk into a room and everyone's American, you're like, which one's Ken? I guarantee someone probably goes, the Asian guy. That's branding, right? So, I mean, this is sort of that uphill battle on it. So like, in fact, what I love about what's happening right now is that the script gets flipped, because I don't think our parents' generation was able to embrace it in the same way and go and be proud of being Vietnamese in the same way that like we are trying to be now, right?
It's ironic
in terms of, and pushing those things forward that like make us wonderful. I mean, from a branding standpoint, for a long time, known for nail salons, you know, like if there was a singular sort of branding for Vietnamese Americans anyway, it was,
nail industry.
And it's not the thing we want to be known for.
But that's like the Cambodians and probably donut shops, or, you know, the Koreans and dry cleaners in the 90s and stuff, 80s and 90s, you know, right? It's not something that they, well, it's not a cultural export.
But they weren't known for, they were known for the industriousness around it, right? Not known for like the product in itself. No one's going like, I want Cambodian donuts.
Yeah.
You know, or I only want like, but people will go, I want Japanese hair straightening. I'm like, what the fuck is that? They have straight hair. Japanese hair straightening.
yeah, it's so weird, right? But I think when it comes to some sort of expression, I think that's where the value is. That's where the money, and that's where the prestige, where people want to be, you know, if it's in the expression, if it's done right, if it feels right, that cultural je ne sais quoi, like if it's just in the pocket of like right for the masses and it hits, it's not about nails or donuts or dry cleaners, or it's more like expression, fashion, film, music, things that are.
We all have to become ambassadors, right? We have to be willing to share it. We have to be willing to share it, and we have to become ambassadors for it, and people have to adopt it and embrace it, right? So like, you look across the board and there's certain things that people are just like uniquely known for. The maritime striped t-shirt, everyone's like, oh, that's the French, right? But like, it seeps into popular culture and they embrace it and they share it, and they consistently put it on everything, and then everyone sees it and it's like, oh yeah, you know, that's French. And yes, the French are known for a lot more than that, but you know, that is one of those things that is also uniquely theirs. And but the bigger point being is like, every Vietnamese person, whatever the thing ultimately comes, we have to be ambassadors for it. We have to go like, this is fucking great, and I rep it and I rock it. And, you know, and if it's the music, I'm going to put it on first before I put on something else, you know, and then I'm going to talk to you about how, like, I definitely know it. Whereas 20 years ago, it was sort of like behind closed doors kind of thing. And I think we broadly had an approach to our culture like that. You know, and I love that those things are changing. But I figure, and you know, tell me if you're wrong, I don't want to make assumptions, but we're of similar ages. I think there was a lot of probably cringing when you opened up your lunchbox at school for the first time, and like the first like whiffs of like Nick Mum like float out, and the other kid, like probably some white kid sitting at your table, like cracks a joke about it all, right?
Yeah, it was like,
And like the first time you come home as like an 8-year-old, and you're like, Mom, don't put that in my lunch. I'm going to buy the school lunch, right? And now, like, I guarantee you, you open your lunch at the office and people are like, what are you having? Like, I grabbed a bun meat. Where? You know, I walked past a shop tonight. And I was just, I was chatting someone up in there, and I saw that they'd ordered a bowl of pho. Got terrible one, but they ordered a bowl of pho. And the first question she asked me is like, where can I get a good one around here? And that's where it starts to normalize. And like, those are the things where like all of a sudden the cultural heritage of our people starts to like seep through.
And then you're flexing. Like,
you know, yeah, that's exactly the right word, where you get to flex your culture, That's probably the best expression for it. And it's like, where are the opportunities for us to flex our culture? And I think when you look at some of the more generic examples, and even like cars, we're not going to get to flex our culture within that unless there's something about it that's uniquely our own, right? So German engineering is uniquely German because of its like rigor and precision to detail, right? Italian cars are Italian because, like, let's face it, when you look at a Ferrari, it evokes the shape of a woman's hips, like on its side. Okay, there is a cultural assumption that we make around that we tie to it that they don't shy away from. They're like, yes, the sensuality is in everything we do, from our food to our cars. We just haven't, and maybe it's just me, maybe other folks who have better able to wrap their heads around their own identity will tell you, yeah, no, these are the things. But I don't necessarily know what those are yet for us that are like uniquely, those unique threads that go through everything that are completely ownable to us.
You know, I think we're going to have to bring on you, Victor Long, Michael Dinn. There's Dan Vo, all these brand guys. Sneakerheads, music guys who just understand culture really well. And we should just do rounds of every month. We just get on and every guy just pick one cool thing that's coming from the Vietnamese culture, whether it's from Vietnam or from the US or from wherever, and just explore it. Because you just brought up a good point. It's like, if you were to ask somebody to really think about it and line it all up, can't really come up with anything off the top of your head. But I think if it was an exercise that we kind of like thought about and we circled around it quite a bit, something's going to come. And this sneaker thing, I'd be very surprised if somebody has not already started to tackle that problem. Because you're right. Like, that's like the land of where these shoes are made. Why would somebody not hop on this opportunity?
Because right now, you're right. They're making the money, making them for someone else. But you can honestly say, like, as we're talking about, the best clothes in the world are made in Vietnam. The best shoes in the world are made in Vietnam. Like, across the board, the tailoring, the quality of it, there's no reason why we shouldn't be known for our tailoring in a way that is better than Savile Row, but instead we're known for like hemming stuff, in those tailoring shops. And it's unfortunate, right? And it's good, honest work. I don't take anything away from it. It was just a branding conversation, right? There was a few years back, one of the outdoor clothing companies, Kiva, I think it was, tried to make basically a conical hat and all that. And they made it out of like rafting material. And I was like, this is awesome, right? Modern interpretation version of this. I remember buying one from REI. And then like my mom looking at me and just going like, come on, you're really going to like walk down the street in the US wearing that? I'm like, it's sunny, it's hot. This thing covers everything. It's better than a fucking cowboy hat. And there was just this bit of like,
is Kiva a Japanese company?
I don't know. I kind of assumed they were just an American company. I didn't even really didn't pay a lot of attention. They make like
everything. Yeah.
Sort of those like hippie slippers kind of thing, sandals.
We need to get this conversation going because I think, because it has to start, all of these things start from a thought, right? All these trends, all these things start from a thought, from a conversation. And, these conversations are happening. They're not happening. They are happening in the world. It's just now I want to start really talking about them more in 2023, like this next year. Like, we got to start knowing more about like the cool hip shit, and I don't want to grow old and go, that's for kids. This is the young kids. I want to get in and know like what is the next thing that we're going to start owning.
Well, I mean, and yeah, you're right. There's something in there that we already own. It's just putting that spin on it all throughout everything, right? And you look at like, I know these other folks you've had on, but like the sisters that started on some, like when you start to see people go, hey, we're going to take that and we're going to put it on like a burger. And we're going to take that and like apply it to when you start to see the recipe for like, this is how we're doing turkey and like Thanksgiving become like Vietnamese tastes and flavors become a natural part of that fabric where people are like, you know, your mashed potatoes don't taste right. They don't taste like lemongrass, you know, like that's where you start to change sort of like the broader, the broader brand perception. Like, you know, what is our German mechanical personality kind of thing?
Yeah.
You know,
what's our profile?
So, but there, I mean, all those things exist. I mean, there's so much that we can take pride in. I think before we started, like, you know, it's just, it's the exercise in finding it, but it's got to be true, right? Branding without like any sort of real depth and like truth to the product fails inevitably. I can go out and tell you like, this is amazing. And if it falls like, or this is like the best coffee in the world and it's not, people will like just shit all over it or forget it and move on quickly. But like Vietnamese coffee has like a unique profile that makes it wonderful, memorable, so that when they say, hey, this is this unique flavor, you know, that is specifically attributed to us. Like, how do we take that and spin it into like inventive and entrepreneurial in the kitchen and like, you know, gastronomic expertise across the board, right? You take that, you know, the sales term, like you land and expand. You've got that thing. Now, how do we like grow it out there? From a fashion standpoint, I want to see like DVF put like an LEI on the red carpet and be like, yeah, you stole that from us because it's awesome, you know? Yeah. And then when I start to normalize and see it, like I remember going to a wedding in Japan and seeing a Japanese woman wearing an LEI, and I went up and I started speaking to her in Vietnamese. And I was like, oh, it's like someone, because I was there at the wedding, I was like, someone I can talk to. And instead she was like, no, I bought this on a trip. But like, part of me was like, heart got really warm around that.
Wow.
You know? So there are those things that we own and we just have to embrace them. And maybe also as we talk about this, and I realize the superficial things that are also wonderful also cross the cultural divide between Vicu and the people in Vietnam right now, because everyone still takes pride in the food, cuisine, you know, pensions for the arts, fashion, and sort of like the industrious and entrepreneurial nature. Those are things that we can take a lot of pride in, you know? I mean, you see it now in this like resurgence of the film industry. Resurgence is probably the wrong word, but like the surge in our film industry and like breaking on to the national, international scene, right? You know, you look at the fact that like Bao does the 30 for 30 on Bruce Lee. Dustin's doing like Warriors, you know, and these are not uniquely there, uniquely Vietnamese, but you've got Vietnamese people at the helm of it who are starting to get
Sundance just released like a lineup, and I think 5 movies that are coming out in 2023 in Sundance have either Vietnamese cast or producers on board.
Yeah.
It's like 5.
So like the next thing I look for is when conventional Hollywood productions go, hey, we want to shoot in Vietnam because there's an industry there, right? We want to like go there and actually like take advantage of the talent, the folks that are there that are on the ground, so we can just like shoot there versus, you know, going to like Argentina or Chile or something like that, you know, or Canada, like how many countless shows are sort of shot there. So I don't know.
It's coming.
It's an interesting.
All of that is coming. You know, George, I look forward. I always say this to every guest and I mean it with you, that I look forward to seeing you, come back, throughout the next few years, because, you know, this is just the start of such a beautiful time in our Vietnamese, culture. To be Vietnamese is such a beautiful thing and such a proud thing after so many years, you know, 40 something years of it being, for me, a very shameful place. Today it's now such a beautiful, and I'm so full of pride to see all of these young people like yourself and all the guests that have come on.
You're so nice calling me young.
A young man like yourself. But I would like to have you come back on and, you know, talk about some cool trends in the future with the branding of the Vietnamese.
Man, I really appreciate that. But, you know, the funny thing I'll say here is I hope that never happens, because there are so many young Vietnamese people who are doing such wonderful things that I think you are going to be very busy for a very long time before that opportunity ever occurs. You know, in the best way possible, I hope you don't have room to ever have me on your show again.
Thank you. That's very flattering. And, you know, I appreciate it. I hope to see you again very soon, either in LA or New York, man.
I hope so too, man. I hope so too.
Thanks for coming on, George.
All right. Take it easy.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.